There's an old saying that river rats are too stubborn to freeze to death, too full of hot air to drown, and too independent to call any one boss. Today, I'll talk with the last river rat. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Kenny Salway is known as the last river rat. He says a river rat is someone who makes his living with the river. He hunts, he traps, he fishes, and he lives in a cabin he built with his own two hands. He also writes about his life and shares his experiences with readers around the world. His latest book is Muskrat for Supper, Exploring the Natural World. I'll talk with him about his life and the river. Join our conversation after the news. This is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Kenny Salway is known as the last river rat, although he says he's only one of the last. River rat is not a title you're born into. It's a title that you earn. And Kenny earned that title by living in a shack on the Mississippi River for 30 years, hunting, trapping, and fishing to keep himself alive. He's also a storyteller and a writer chronicling his experiences and the seasons on the river. His latest book is called Muskrat for Supper, Exploring the Natural World with the Last River Rat, and he is here with me today. Hello, Kenny.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for coming into the studio today.
It's entirely my pleasure. And before we begin, or as we are beginning, I'd like to say a couple things, if I might.
Sure.
First of all, you have a lovely name. Charity is so nice, so
well,
nice.
Thank you.
Secondly, the Iowa Public Radio. I am a big fan of all public radio, and Iowa in particular. Iowa has its radio for the people and by the people, and that is just it's such an honor to always be able to visit with the folks on any public radio station, and in particular, Iowa.
Well, Kenny, it's just wonderful to have you here today. And let's go back in time to your childhood. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Buffalo County, Wisconsin. Buffalo County, Wisconsin is a very, very rural and lightly populated, to say the least, county. Back in 1965, there were about 14,000 people in Buffalo County, and the last session, or the last, where they take the poll of the how many people there are, the census, there were 13,640. So we're not exactly growing by leaps and bounds, population-wise, and most of us folks that live there kind of like it like that. It's a mini Appalachia. There's a lot of hills along the Mississippi River. The Mississippi River forms the western boundary of Buffalo County. And, of course, across the river is Minnesota. And we have one stoplight in Buffalo County, and we think that's one too many. We blame that on Winona, Minnesota, which is just across the river. And so most of us folks know each other. Many of us are related, so some perhaps even a little too closely. You just might be listening to one of those. So we don't take ourselves real seriously in terms of life, in hurry-scurry life. We like to kick back and take it easy, and I always like to say that life is too short to hurry through it. So I was born July 12, 1943, in my mother's own bed. The medical profession, of course, was much different then. They actually came to see you. And they, after I was able to get out and about at an early age, probably 4 or 5 years old, I was born 4 miles, of course, east of the big river in that hill country, and there's creeks there. I know the correct word is creek. We just call them creeks. And in the creeks are trout generally, and there was a trout creek right below our little dirt farm. And my mother would send me down to catch a trout, and I would end up many times chasing grasshoppers and frogs through the meadows. And then I'd crawl out on the bluffs, and they are about 500 to 600 feet high, and I would pretend I was a red-tailed hawk, and I could soar out over the valley, and I could see forever, and life was good. And then one day my mother called me to the back porch, and she said, "Kenny, tomorrow you have to go to school." Well, it was all kind of downhill from there. I always knew that my brother went there. It was a little one-room country school. And I never dreamt I'd have to, and they wanted me to be there every day. And my nature was such that I didn't get there every day. And when I did, I was looking out of the windows, wishing I was outside, chewing the covers off the books, making paper airplanes out of the paper. And then when I was 17, I knew more than my teacher. There was one teacher for 8 grades, knew more than she did by far. And then I got to the point where I knew more than my parents did. And so I went off and joined the Army. And on a weekend pass, I went to New York City and stood on the corner of 42nd Street in Times Square. And there that slick little country bumpkin who didn't have to do his homework, laughed at those who did, was in culture shock. Eyes the size of silver dollars and mouth hanging open. I didn't realize they could build buildings that tall. I didn't know there were that many people in the whole world, let alone one town. And that's when I realized I missed something very precious and special called education. And I should have been reading those books and writing on that paper. So my career opportunities were limited, so to speak. So I came back to Buffalo County and went into a place called the Whitman Swamp, a 6,000-acre swamp and off from the main channel of the Mississippi River. So when it is said that I lived on the Mississippi River, it's correct only in the sense that I lived on the backwaters, adjacent to the main channel of the river, Charity. And there I began to eke out a living as a river rat.
So when you went back to the Mississippi River, you were running away from something?
I was going home. I was going home to the place that I knew and to the skills, that the only skills that I knew. And yes, on the other hand, I was running away. I was running away from people. I did not like people. I felt inferior to people. And I just wanted to put as much distance between me and them as I could. And I did. And so for the next 28 years, I eked out a living there as a river rat, trapping, hunting, fishing, digging roots and herbs, and once in a great while doing a little guiding for folks and just staying to myself.
You built yourself a home to live in. Tell me about the shack.
Well, the first shack, Charity, was I inherited that, so to speak, from an old river rat. And that one is still out there. It's called the Marsh Shack. And that sets on barrels, goes up and down with the water, and has four wooden bunks, a wood-burning stove, kerosene lamps for light. And I met the old fellow who used to live there, or was living there at that time, one day in the swamp, and he said, "Kenny, would you like to take over my Marsh Shack? I'm getting up in years," and his eyesight was failing, and he said, "Would you care to take it over?" And I said, "Would I?" So I took it over first, and that shack was built in 1952, and so it's seen a lot of water come and go. And then I built a shack called Big Lake Shack, which is also still there today. And it sits on high ground that does not flood. And it has four wooden bunks and kerosene lamps for light and an old wooden table that's fashioned in such a way on hinges that I can flop it up against the wall, and in case I ever took to feeling like I might want to dance or something. And then I dug out a spring lined with rocks for water, and then I built the third shack. It was called the tent camp. And it was just what its name implies, canvas stretched over peeled poles. Sat on a little wooden platform. It was in the form of a wall tent and had a small stove and an army cot and some five-gallon pails with lids for cupboards and closets. And so, Charity, those were my three homes, so to speak, during those 28 years.
We need to take a short break, and then we'll continue our conversation in a moment. My guest today is Kenny Salway. He is known as the Last River Rat. He is a river rat, had lived for 30 years along the Mississippi River, eking out a living by hunting, trapping, and fishing. He is also a master storyteller and a writer. His most recent book is called Muskrat for Supper, Exploring the Natural World with the Last River Rat. It's a book aimed at young children and people who have young children in their lives who they'd like to get out into nature. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Let it rain, let it pour, let it rain. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Kenny Salway. He is known as the Last River Rat, and a river rat is someone who lives along the Mississippi River and hunts, traps, fishes to support themselves. And Kenny did that for 30 years, living, he was just describing for us before the break, living in a shack called Big Lake Shack and supporting himself on the river. Kenny, did you buy land along the river? How were you able to build these shacks?
I did not buy land, Charity. The land was privately owned by absentee landowners. One lived in Colorado and the other in St. Louis. And so they had grown up there on that land. However, their parents had died, and I was a caretaker for that land. They also owned some agricultural land adjacent to the swamp. And they had a house out on toward the highway. And so I took care of those things for those folks. And in return, they allowed me to use their land and to build the shacks and to be a good steward of that land. And that's what I always tried to do.
You didn't spend all those years out there alone. Where did you meet your wife?
Well, I was married at an early age, and my first wife had was working in a medical clinic about 20 miles away, and we had a little cottage in Buffalo City, Wisconsin, and I, of course, I was certainly at fault in terms of being selfish and just wanting to be out there. And I found out that when you're married, it's nice if you spend some time together. And so that didn't work out. And 15 years ago, I remarried a lady who is the wildlife education specialist for the entire state of Wisconsin. And we now, no longer live in the swamp. And we're building an old new house. We've torn down a couple of barns and a house and a granary. And we have 80 acres of land a couple miles from the river. And just she is, of course, from academia. She's an academic-oriented person. And I'm come from the school of hard knocks, you could say. So together, we're trying to combine the best of those two worlds and in terms of educating and carrying on the great circle of life to see that it's well taken care of and hopefully respected and loved. And so it's been a great thing.
When you went back to the river and started making a living by hunting, by trapping, by fishing, how did you learn all of the things that you needed to know to keep yourself afloat, to keep yourself alive?
Well, I had some relatives who were river rats, which helped a great deal. And then I like to say that I kept my eating hole shut and my listening ones open around the old-time river rats. They were very secretive, and they wouldn't just say, "Well, come on here, son, I'll show you where to catch catfish. I'll show you where to get the mink and the muskrats and all that sort of thing." So I kept company with them as much as I could and simply listened. And then I did a lot of reading in terms of various plants and so forth. Reading became my obsession. Strangely enough, with my record as a student, and I read everything I could lay my hands on, and so I guess it was a combination of a few things.
You described yourself as selfish. You just wanted to be out there on the river, doing what you wanted to be doing, living that way. At what point did you realize that you had something to share with other people?
Well, that was when, excuse me, an old game warden came to the tent camp and asked me to take his place telling or doing a presentation for 55 teachers. They were teaching about the Upper Mississippi River, and this was Fish and Wildlife and Department of Natural Resources folks. And he said, there's a banquet for the 55 teachers on Saturday night, and he said, I'm supposed to do a nature talk for those folks, but I can't make it. Wondering if you could. Well, you could have knocked me over with a feather. I said, I should go. I never liked school. Never liked school teachers going to be surrounded by 55 of them. I ain't so sure right now, Jim, that I like game wardens. So Jim said, well, you know, you are so selfish and you don't give anything back to nature. All your life you just take, take, take. And I said, well, what would I do there? He said, well, tell some stories. You come from a long line of storytellers. And he said, you might actually enjoy it. They might. And not only that, you get $25 and a free meal. And I said, I'll go. So I went for all the wrong reasons. And when I got there, I was as nervous as a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
I got up, told some stories, and to my surprise, some of the teachers invited me to come to their schools and do the same for their students. Even more surprisingly, I said I would, and I did. And I found out a most peculiar paradox that if I am to see the natural world remain healthy and happy the way I hope to see it remain, I have to give it away in order to keep it. If folks don't know about something, they can't love it. Once they do know about something, they can love it, and then they can respect it. And then they'll take care of it. And that's the reason that I'm doing what I am today. There are only two great resources in the world, our natural resources and our human resources. And as the natural resources go, so will the human resources. So the children are our only really great hope. Us older folks have not done such a good job overall. It'd be nice if we could say, well, don't worry, kids, just do what we did. It's all laid out there for you. We can't do that. We have to ask our children to do better. And they will. There's no question. Every generation has had to listen to older folks say, ah, those young people, they're going to the proverbial hot spot in a handcart. Not true. This generation coming up now are more environmentally aware, better educated, and there is just a great, great hope. I have a faith in the young people. The definition of faith is a belief in something not yet beheld. It is being beheld right now. We have Earth Day, environmental days. We have river cleanups. We have adopt a highway. We have recycling. So the future looks great to me.
You're listening to Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. My guest is Kenny Salway. He's known as the Last River Rat, and his most recent book is Muskrat for Supper, Exploring the Natural World with the Last River Rat. Kenny, when you started doing those talks, you must have done a lot of thinking, because I imagine that between living a certain way of life and having a philosophy that you could share with people about why you live that way, that seems like there must have been a bit of a leap there. Did you have to do a lot of soul searching?
Oh, sure. Charity, there, as I say, life is too short to hurry through it. And I never did hurry. I wear a turtle foot as a sign of my symbolic animal, because I'm much like a turtle. I walk slow, talk slow, drive slow, think slow, write slow. And I always took plenty of time to sit back and think and to have quiet time. And When one does that, one becomes more observant and, I think, more introspective. And so, yeah, I've always searched my soul and thought about a lot of things. I had a lot of time to think. And these days, I make it a point to take the time to think and to kick back and relax. And we stayed, my publisher, Sam Shinta from Fulcrum Publishing Company out of Golden, Colorado, has been driving me on this trip. And we put on probably 1,600 miles. And wherever we go, Sam is of the same thought as I am. We try to slow down and take a little time every day to look at things and discuss things. And this morning, overnight, we stayed at Council Bluffs, and outside of the motel there were some rose bushes, small rose bushes, and some of them were blooming. The old saying, stop and smell the roses. And we both did that this morning. Take a few minutes. You can hear the whine of the traffic out on the interstate, and you know that people are in a hurry. And there's, I sometimes wonder why. But I suppose most of those people have an opportunity to stop and smell the roses in their own way, some place, sometime. I hope so, each day.
When did you start writing?
I began writing in 1990, about 93, for a publication, a magazine out of Winona, Minnesota called Big River. And Big River covers the upper Mississippi from the Twin Cities to the Quad Cities. And I wrote a monthly column called The Almanac, which was a phonology about what was going on along the river in terms of the natural world each month. I did 5 years' worth of those, and before that, I would write on these old bank calendars that had these great big squares for each day, just a couple sentences, nothing long, but it was a journal, and I dearly loved to journal. And so after that, a guy named J. Scott Bestel, writes for Field and Stream, came to the swamp and wrote an article about me coming. He called it Coming Out of the Swamp. That's when I first began doing storytelling and nature talks and so forth. And afterward, he said, let's write a book together. And so we wrote a book, 12 chapters, one for each month, and the first part of each chapter, we condensed the almanacs, and so we had a page of almanacs for that month, and then he would come 2 to 3 days a month and spend some time with me, tagging along as a budding river rat. And he would, then he wrote a chapter about that. And then we finished each chapter with what is called a rat tale, T-A-L-E. And that was one of my oral stories written down. So that was the first book that I co-authored. And then from there, I just found that I loved to write. And so I wrote several other books, and And now I've written my first, it's supposed to be a children's book, not in the traditional sense. It's, I don't know, probably 100 pages long or so. And it's geared toward perhaps older children. But I think it's for kids of all ages. When we become adults, sometimes we lose that wonderful sense of curiosity and innocence of a child. But some of us retain that, and so I think it might be a nice read for anybody of any age who has a little childishness left in them.
We'll talk more about some of the ideas that you share in that book, Muskrat for Supper, Exploring the Natural World with the Last River Rat, in just a moment. My guest today is Kenny Salway. He is known as The Last River Rat. That's the title of the first book that he published, The Last River Rat, Kenny Salway's Life in the Wild. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Kenny Salway. He's known as the Last River Rat, and he spent 30 years living in a shack on the Mississippi, hunting, trapping, and fishing to support himself. His latest book is called Muskrat for Supper, Exploring the Natural World with the Last River Rat. And Kenny, what made you want to write a book for a young audience?
Well, that's very easy to answer, Charity, because the children, as I said, are our great hope, and we need to reconnect them as much as possible with the natural world, with the circle of life. And if we do nothing else with this book, but reconnect even one child to touch their attitudes and values toward nature, then it's all worthwhile. So that's why I wanted to do something for children, and I hope to do more.
You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Bill is on the line now from Sac City. Hi, Bill.
Well, hi, Charity, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What would you like to talk about?
Good. Well, in a way, Mr. Salway kind of answered my question in that he said, you know, we need to reconnect at least one child to nature. But my question is what more, in addition to that comment that you just made, what more can we as adults do that we are not currently doing to make our children and grandchildren more sensitive to our environment and the better care of it?
Bill, I would say the best thing we can do, whenever possible, is to take them with us, take them outdoors. It doesn't have to be a grand trip somewhere to huge vistas or exotic places. It could be in the backyard. Maybe it's a vacant lot in an inner city. Maybe it's a small patch of woods. Maybe it's a park. There's all sorts of opportunities, and I don't think there's any better way than role modeling. Taking them out there, sitting down with them, spending some quiet time, and just enjoying. You see, in the spring of the year, the birds come back, and they sing for us. They all sing a different song, and they all sing in a different key, and they all sing at the same time. Now, if we tried that, you couldn't take it in the same room. But the bird chorus is just lovely. And the birds are singing for you when you're there to listen. There's just no end to the opportunities to introduce youngsters to the outdoors.
In your book, Muskrat for Supper, you write about walking through the woods, and you recommend having a walking stick. And I get the impression that you use a walking stick not so much to support you when you walk, although that's helpful on a nice steep hill, but as a way to slow down and notice your environment. How does it help you do that?
Charity helps you do that by when you're walking without a walking stick, you're not liable to stop too often, and so you go by things. When you have a walking stick, of course, it's a third leg going up a hill. You can use it for balance crossing a log. You can use it to test the depth of the water or the mud. You can look under plants or such without stooping over. You can move, let's say, a snake or some other animal out of the path gently and with respect. And then most of all, you try it sometime. You probably have, but if you haven't, you take a group of friends out and you make them each a simple walking stick and give everybody one, and you'll be walking along, and then one person will stop and they'll lean on the thing. And then pretty soon everybody stopped and leaning on the walking stick. When you do that, you become more observant and introspective, and you're able to observe quiet time, and you slow down. And so, yeah, walking sticks are... Thoreau didn't go anywhere without his walking stick, and I totally agree.
Kids are natural explorers. They just seem to be able to do that. But I think as we grow, it's something that a lot of us lose the ability to do, or at least the idea of doing that. So yeah. Do you have recommendations or any advice for grown-ups who want to get out there with kids and explore, but maybe in this day and age we think, well, we have to walk fast to get exercise, or we have to go high so we can see this vista.
Yeah.
What should we do to help ourselves get back into the kind of mindset that comes so naturally to our kids?
Follow the kids. Let them lead the hike. You're not going to get too far because they're going to stop and they're going to look at a magic rock. They're going to find everything of interest. They'll be looking at leaves, looking at little sticks. Everything that they come across is interesting to them. And if they start, wanting to run or so forth, well, then say, wait a minute now, Johnny or Sally, let's slow up a little bit, and then you can kind of gauge the hike. You don't have to be in a hurry. That's the first thing I would talk over before you start the hike. We're not going to hurry here today. There's no place that we need to go in a big hurry. And you'll fall into that natural rhythm.
Dan is on the line from Dubuque. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, it's wonderful to hear you, Kenny. You remind me very much of me. I'm in my late 40s, and I started a little late having kids. My nickname's Pogo. We like to call the boys the Poglets, but we spend an awful lot of time outside. And my wife and I both, we hike with the kids weekly, and we spend a lot of time fishing and walking, and I trap for a living in the fall. So everything you've said, just from taking a short hike, we like to have a fire about halfway through our hike, and then at that point we turn around and head home. But following the boys was one of the things on my that I wanted to make a comment on there. The things, even as you grow older, even as you're like you said, if you still have a little childlike in you, they'll pick out all kinds of little things, from the pinchers on a beetle to a Mayflower growing up through a leaf, or whatever those little things are. You're very correct on that. That's a wonderful thing there that you mentioned.
Well, Dan, thanks so much for sharing that
with
us.
The one other thing I can tell you real quick, and Kenny, is I think the main thing parents need to do is get rid of their television, or at least we don't have any television at all. But we have one that just doesn't work. And these games, these kids are so strung out on the games. Wouldn't you agree with that, Kenny? That
I certainly would, Dan. We do not have a television that gets stations. We use it for DVDs. And that's part of it, certainly. And, of course, it's become a visual world. We have our computers and our TVs, and there's very little chance for conversation there, which is kind of a downfall. But there again, there are a lot of good things about those. The old ways are not necessarily all good. The new ways are not all good. We pick the best of both worlds, and then we hopefully have a better one. And a fire, Dan, very good. There's nothing like a little campfire. And fire is like water, running water. It mesmerizes you. You ever sit down with a group of people that you don't know very well around a campfire, and it isn't long you're conversing and you're sharing thoughts and ideas and just sitting there looking into that fire. I kind of have a typical Kenny Solway idea. Washington Square, out in Washington, D.C., why not build some fire circles? And then we'll get some politicians from each party and we'll set them around these fire circles every Friday night or whenever, Monday morning, I guess. and they can roast some marshmallows, and I'll just bet you they'd be talking to each other after an hour or so. And that might be the answer to the impasse that we have right now in our political system. It's pretty simple, so I doubt whether it'll be adopted. But, Dan, I'm very proud of you, and proud of your family, and it's great to hear from you.
Dan, thank you so much for calling. And one of the things that you write about in this latest book is hunting with children, taking children out into the wilderness and teaching them hunting skills. And, of course, you hunted, you trapped, you fished to support yourself, to keep yourself alive. You didn't take more than you needed.
Right.
Do you see a difference between what you did and hunting for recreation, which is so common in our culture now?
Well, there are, to begin with, charity. Hunting is not about killing. It gives you an opportunity to kill something, but you do not have to kill anything to have it be a successful hunt. You just being out there and enjoying the sunrise, the sunset, the feel of the wind on your cheek, the sight of animals and birds. Today, that's what hunting really is about. Certainly, if you do kill an animal, it must be used. Every part of it must be used. And the children should be involved in that as well. And then, of course, in the cooking of the meat. And so fishing as well. Fishing is not about catching. If it were, we'd call it catching. We're going catching today, but we're going fishing. And that's about seeing the great blue heron and the white-tailed deer and the fawn coming down to the water to drink and to smell the plum blossoms and to listen to the ripple of the water, to feel the gentle waves on your canoe or your boat. And being together, it's a way of youngsters spending time with adults. However, attitudes and values need to be correctly implemented. An outdoor experience evokes feelings. Feelings produce attitudes and values. Attitudes and values, in turn, create behavior. And that's what we're all about, is how we behave toward the great circle of life.
We have an email from Larry. He says, you've seen a lot of changes in your time on the river. What change makes you most depressed?
Well, right now, it used to be pollution on the Mississippi River in particular. Point source pollution, pipes sticking out from houses, industry, whatever. But that's pretty well been addressed. That's been taken care of for the most part. Now it's siltation. Siltation, a major river, is a reflection of its tributaries. And what's done in the tributaries is done to the big river. It's like let's say the big river is a washtub or a bathtub. And above it is a spigot. The spigot is a tributary. Out of that spigot is running some water and a lot of silt. And the traditional approach has been to empty the washtub by dredging. Why not try to get that spigot under control and have good land stewardship on the tributaries? And then the problem would be solved. Siltation covers aquatic plants, the roots and seeds, and then the sun cannot germinate them.
And, Kenny, we only have about a minute left. What change have you seen that makes you the most hopeful?
Oh, the clarity of the water. The Mississippi River is much clearer than it ever has been. Also, the silent, so-called silent sports now, kayaking, canoeing, have really taken off in recent years. And that is a wonderful thing because people can get off of the main river into the backwaters, which are the nursery of life. And you see a lot of kids doing that.
Kenny Salway, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Charity.
Kenny Salway is known as the Last River Rat. His latest book is Muskrat for Supper, Exploring the Natural World with the Last River Rat, a book for young readers. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Technical support from Rick Fredrickson in Des Moines today. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, Iowan Olympians in History. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.